The Lie derivative is something which takes a derivative of a geometrical quantity along the lines which are associated with a vector field V. So the idea of these curves here is that at every point on the curve, V is the tangent vector. So sometimes these are called integral curves. So it's like you've sort of integrated the vector field up. So yeah, I guess you could think about them sort of a bit analogous to lines of force, you know, the electric and magnetic field. So the idea is that typically with a derivative, you know, you're comparing things at nearby points. And so in this particular case, this vector, which is, if you have a sort of separate vector field U, and you have, you know the value of U at the point P plus delta P, you use the vector field V to take U at P and essentially push it forward to the U at P plus delta P, so that now the two vectors are in the same tangent space and can therefore be properly subtracted. So that's the idea of the Lie derivative. If it's on two vectors, then you actually have a definition in terms of a commutator. And in general, I suppose I should keep be consistent. So that's the pattern. So the more, the higher the rank of the tensor, the more terms that you have to put in. So there are various ways in which the Lie derivative can be useful. And one of the things I'd like to just discuss, if I can get my spelling right, see if I can. Is what it actually represents. So to try and get a geometrical picture of what this Lie derivative means. And so what in flat space and sort of standard Cartesian coordinates, we're kind of used to this idea that if we go a little bit along x, a little bit along y, that's the same as going a little bit along y and then a little bit along x. So in that case, our lines, if you like, our x-axis lines, to which d by dx is tangent, and the y-axis lines are completely commutative. So, the, you know, in that case, our coordinate basis closes. But for general vector fields, this need not be the case. And that's what the Lie derivative tells us. So, in general, if I go a little bit along a curve to which V is tangent, and then a little bit along a curve to which U is tangent, and then compare that to having gone the other way, a bit along U and a bit along V, then I don't actually necessarily get to the same point. And what I'm going to, what I claim, is that the difference is something which is proportional to the Lie derivative, and the difference is a second order effect, because you expect if you just go a little bit along the curves, you're not going to be too far off, but you don't necessarily get to exactly the same point. So, it's really telling you something about how non-commutative the operation is of going along a little bit along U and a little bit along V. So let's actually see how that arises. What we're going to do is to go into a local coordinate chart and simply look at the coordinates of B and the coordinates of D. So first of all, let's just see how we go along, let's say, from 0 to A, a little bit along V. So the little noughts are just meant to be sort of indicating that in the end we're sort of going to evaluate everything at the point O. But all I'm doing here is Taylor expanding around this origin or O here. And so I want to go a little bit along V to leading order. That's just going to be S plus SV. And then, of course, we've got a sort of second order term. And then, of course, our vector U at the point A is simply going to be given by its value at the point O plus a little piece representing the fact that you've moved along the line V. So those are the basic sort of Taylor expansion type expressions we need, and all we're going to do is just put them in and see what we get for B and see what we get for D. So first of all, looking at B, we want to know what the coordinates are at B. Well, if I look at what I wrote for XA, B, I get to B by going a little bit T along the curve defined by U. So that's going to be XA plus T U plus a half T squared. I've got my S's and S's and T's mixed up here. Okay, so all I do is I say, well, to get to the point B, I've simply got to move along from A along the curve U. So that's my Taylor series there. And then I'm only ever going to keep things to second order. So you could say plus order cubed, you know, S or T cubed. And then I simply now rewrite the expressions today in terms of expressions at zero. It's S or T. So that's the first term. The second term, UA, that was why I wrote this term down here. So I've got plus T, U naught mu plus ST, V naught mu, U naught mu comma nu. And then this final term is already at second order. So all I do is replace those little A's by noughts. So that's my expression for B. Now, in order to get to D, all I do is swap U and V and swap S and T. So having swapped the roles of U, V, and S, and T, you can see that most of the terms are, in fact, almost identical. And the only one that isn't is the ST term. And sure enough, when you actually write that down, you see that it is, in fact, the commutator of U and V. So what the Lie derivative is telling us is a little bit about whether or not you can use U and V to make a coordinate system. So obviously, if U and V don't commute, you can't use these integral curves to define a set of coordinates, because obviously a set of coordinates has to be a unique labeling of every point. And so if it makes a difference whether you go first U, then V, or V, then U, obviously, that's no use. So, what is true, however, is if you've got, I'll just mention it rather than write it down, is if you've got a set of vectors which don't necessarily commute if you take a pair, but the commutator still lies within, you know, the space spanned by your set of vectors, then that generally indicates that indicates you can choose a set of coordinates. So those vectors will span a surface, which can then be coordinatized, you know, in some sensible fashion. So killing vectors, these are actually quite important in gravity, because general relativity, we've already met it, so you know something about it. You know it's highly nonlinear. So it's a very coupled theory, and it's highly nonlinear, and it's very hard to find solutions. We're kind of lucky that most of the solutions that we're interested in, we can actually find. So I think Einstein would have been laughed out of court if he couldn't even have produced something that represented a star, right, or the sun, or the Earth. So it is luck, that, or it's very useful, that we can, in fact, solve so many systems of physical interest. But a lot of that comes down to symmetry. And so underlying symmetry is something which we sort of call a killing vector. So the Lee derivative is really telling us something about how things change along these curves associated with a vector field. And so if things aren't changing, that's kind of telling you that these curves are representing some sort of constancy of that particular object. So in particular, our distance function, the metric, if the Lee derivative of the metric vanishes along a particular set of curves, that's kind of saying that the metric's not changing along those curves. And so that's a symmetry of our space. So vectors for which the Lie derivative of the metric vanishes are called Killing vectors. And they're pretty important when you're trying to generate exact solutions because they represent some sort of symmetry. And usually they mean that you can choose coordinates such that your metric is simpler. So your typical examples, or the usual examples, are things like d by dt, static, if you're trying to find the Schwarzschild solution. Another common example is SO3, so spherical symmetry. And there's sort of several others. So basically, a killing vector will allow you to make simplifications in your choice of metric. So there's also a relationship between D and the Lie derivative. Which is simply telling you something about how if you take the derivative of one form and then look at how it acts on a pair of vectors, then you can represent that in terms of, it's essentially you see this sort of commutator structure coming up again and again. So D is, of course, antisymmetric. It's a completely antisymmetric derivative. And so you would expect to see on the right-hand side, something which was completely antisymmetric in U and V. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say about the Lie derivative. And now I want to look at the final way in which you can take a derivative on a manifold, at least that we'll be concerned with, which is, of course, the one that you first meet, usually, in a course on general relativity. So this is the standard covariant derivative. And so in the Lie derivative, you use a vector field to take nearby, so you want to compare your vector field at a point with the vector field at a nearby point. You use the integral curve of V to drag that U forward there. Another way of doing it, which doesn't depend on the underlying vector field, is to instead have a set of rules, if you like, to take you from one tangent space to another. So that's called the connection. It's a way of deciding how to relate two nearby tangent spaces. So if you, probably quite a useful way, maybe you all completely understand and totally happy with it, but in terms of visualization, actually going back to R cubed and looking at spherical polar bases is often quite useful for developing good intuition on what's going on with connections and tangent spaces. Because the spherical polar basis, the orthonormal basis, ER, E theta, E phi, changes as you move around in R cubed. So that actually has a non-trivial effect as you go between different tangent spaces at different points. And of course there you know how to connect things together because it's flat space and you have an overall sense of direction. So you know how to parallel transport your basis around, and therefore you know how to compare this orthonormal basis at two neighboring points. In a general curve manifold, you can't necessarily do that in a sort of, you don't have an overall sense of direction, I suppose that's the way of putting it. And so the connection is what tells you how to change one basis into another. So what we want to do, or what the connection is, we say that our connection, our grad, acting on EB, so you write it with respect to a particular basis. So you're thinking of this covariant, this grad or nabla, as a sort of covector, although it isn't by itself a geometric object. E is obviously a vector. And so on the right-hand side, what you must have is a mixed tensor, a vector and a covector part. So this is the basis for that. And so you have to have a set of elements. And so these are labeled gamma. So this is indeed going to be the gamma that you were introduced to in your first relativity course. I don't want to sort of get into huge amounts of formalism, but this may look a bit strange because when you first meet covariant differentiation, you meet it as differentiation, and you're sort of looking at what pieces do you have to add to partial derivatives to give you something that is well-defined, that's a geometric object, transforms as a tensor. Here, it doesn't look like I've actually done anything so far. It doesn't look like I've taken derivatives. But I have, in a way, because what this is telling me is how the basis at one point is going to link to basis at some other point. And so this grad, if you want to actually say how is it defined, so it's a derivation which so this is actually all you need for grad to be the covariant derivative. It's got to be something which is like taking a derivative. So for example, if you act on a function, it should just give you d. So then you know that it's something that is actually taking a rate of change of something. You need it to commute with contraction. So in other words, if you've got an expression which is like omega contracted with u, so that's meant to be a scalar, then you know that has to be d of omega contracted with u. Grad of omega u has to be the same as d of omega u. And so it's really sort of saying that you can pull that grad through an expression, and you're simply going to act on each in turn, which is this Leibnizian part. And so for a general vector, if I look at grad V and say, well, what does that look like? Well, that's grad acting on VA, EA, if I write it in a particular basis. So this is where we're coming to this bit with the abstract index notation issue. So here, V is a vector, E is a vector, VA, the components of V, they're just scalars. Grad acting on a scalar reduces to D. And because this is Leibnizian, I take grad on V first times EA, and then I add VA times grad of VA. So grad of VA is just D of VA. And then I have to add VA grad EA. So this first piece I can write as VA comma B, omega B tensor EA. And the second bit, well, I just wrote down what grad of EA was. And so if I pull all these together, relabeling indices, so what's in brackets there is actually the familiar expression for the covariant derivative. So here you're sort of seeing this, if you like, this whole issue or the deal I was making about abstract index notation. This is actually quite a good illustration. These V's really are scalars. I didn't do anything other than take D of them. But what I end up with, if I look at the components of grad V, the components of grad V are the partial derivatives of V plus the connection times V. And so because we have to do a lot of practical calculation when we're looking at physics of gravity rather than mathematics of geometry, it's much more convenient to kind of jettison this whole geometric construction and just write these expressions and say, well, this, so grad V AB to say that this is simply this covariant derivative. So if you like, this would be the sort of the physics side, and this other side is more the math side. So more or less, you don't have to worry about it, but I'm just keep on making a deal about it, because when we go through these sorts of arguments, you can sometimes think, hang on, why is she taking grad of, you know, XAB and just put D there, or partial derivative, okay? So gravity, in gravity, our fundamental observable really is distance. So that's kind of what tells us about the manifold around us. We're always either measuring distances or measuring time. And so we find the metric that we put on our space-time manifold is kind of central importance. And so we choose our connection to actually tally with our concept of distance and direction. So that's the reason we choose the metric connection in GR. Because to us, we have an instinctive notion of parallel transport. So this connection, I haven't sort of used that phrase, parallel transport, but it's exactly the same thing. I've said it in a way of linking tangent spaces. What are you doing? You're taking a basis in one tangent space, and you're saying it's equivalent, you know, it sort of maps onto this basis or this particular combination of the basis vectors in a neighboring tangent space. How would you know how to do that? How would we do that as physicists? Well, we'd say, oh, but I know which direction is up, so I'm going to keep that direction as I move over here. So that's an obvious thing to do. So our metric is, well, formally it's a rank two symmetric, you know, covariant tensor, but it means, you know, we take it to mean a local representation of distance. So in this case, our sort of covariant derivative really does tell us now corresponds to parallel transport. There's another, actually, this is not the only condition we have to put on our connection, but you may or may not have noticed, but I was being really very careful about the ordering of my indices on this gamma. And the reason is that it's possible that the connection might not be symmetric. So always, the sort of differentiating part or index corresponds to this first component there. So this is summed up in what's called torsion. So we can write the torsion TUV. Make sure I get my ordering right. So the torsion is something which is almost saying that gamma is symmetric, but not quite, because this little bit here. So it's essentially saying that a connection is symmetric, but because if I look for it in components, so I remark that you could have situations where you had a sort of non-trivial Lie bracket, but as long as you sort of had a sort of subspace spanned by a set of vectors where the Lie bracket operation was closed, then that still meant you could coordinatize the space. Well, here we're sort of seeing that if we choose a general basis, the Lie bracket of our basis vectors may not close. So obviously it always does in a coordinate basis, right? Because it, by definition, we can see that right from that sort of first board there. If we're in a coordinate basis, we have a unique labeling of every point, which means that it, you know, going along our coordinate lines is a commutative operation. So there's no structure constants for a coordinate basis. But a general basis will, in general, have non-zero Lie brackets for at least some of its elements. And so those are called structure constants. It's just part of the Lie algebra of that particular basis. And so you'll find that a lot of the expressions that we write down for components of things often have these C's in them. And it's really just, it's like keeping everything accurate. It's just allowing for the fact that you may have chosen a slightly awkward basis from this perspective, although from other perspectives it might be a very sensible choice. So if we actually look at the what this actually means, and so look at what the components. So if we have both of these requirements, so we see we can actually derive from the fact that the metric is covariantly conserved, we find that these are the expressions for the connection components in a coordinate basis. So that's the sort of familiar expression for gamma, the Christoffel symbols. What I want to do, though, is to kind of just keep things a little bit more general for a while, because what I want to discuss is a formalism called the Cartan formalism for computing connections and curvature. And so I want to, instead of kind of going to having lots of indices like this or lots of explicit components, I want to try and sort of keep more on the geometric or algebraic side to see, you know, other ways of computing curvatures. So what I want to do is I'm just, first of all, I'm going to take my connection components and define a one form by simply absorbing this, what I call the differentiating index, with a basis element, a one form basis element. Then if I look at the symmetric part of my connection one forms, I have that they're actually equal to the derivative D acting on the components of my metric. So what this says is if I'm picking one of these orthonormal bases, yeah?
Just to make sure, there A and C are not components.
So these are one forms, right? So the theta is a one form, but as you say, so the A and C label, so there's a whole set of one forms labeled by A and C. So the fact that theta is a one form is because you've kind of used this omega, but then there are a whole set of them, depending on how many dimensions you're in, labeled by this A and C. So let me demonstrate like why this is the case. So so let's look at D of GAB. So I can write this as grad, because grad reduces to D on functions. And then I write down what I mean by GAB. So GAB are the components of G in the basis EA. So all that means, this is what this means. And so that means if I use the property of commutation with contractions and the fact that grad G is zero, I have that. So I'm really sort of, hopefully each step is reasonably clear. So of course, grad of EA, I basically wrote that down there. Now you see why I defined the connection one forms the way I did, because over here, you can see that this is just theta CB tensor EC. So you can see the theta's coming up from here. So this means I get so theta CB CA. So all I've got here, these are just the components of G, GCB. So this is theta BA, and this other one is theta AB. So that's why having an orthonormal basis is so useful from this perspective, because it tells you that these thetas are anti-symmetric in A and C. So as Anna asked or pointed out, the A and C are just labeling a whole set of different thetas. And in principle, there's going to be as many thetas as you can make choices of A and C. If you can reduce the number, it means you have less to calculate. And so this reduces the number. So then, if I look at what I want to do is play with an object looking at the wedge product of a theta with a basis element. So, I mean, at the moment, I'm just sort of rewriting things. So I've got my connection components here. I know that this is anti-symmetric in my omegas. So I take gamma ABC minus gamma ACB. But then, somewhere, I wrote down what the torsion was. The torsion was simply the anti-symmetric part of the connection with a correction coming from the structure constants. So I know that this term here is simply the torsion plus my, make sure I get the index order right, plus my structure constants. Now, the first part of that expression is simply telling me I could relabel that as a two form, or set of two forms. So those are, this is a torsion two form. I'm really just doing that as shorthand. And then the second part are the structure constants. And if, again, I look at the top board on the right, I see the structure constants are defined via a commutator of the basis vectors. So what I've really got with that C is a commutator of basis vectors acted on by an element of the dual basis. And so I wrote down this relation here in terms of relating the D and the Lie bracket. So you can see, in particular, this last term here is really what's looking like the structure constant term there. So what I've done here is simply use this identity to change my Lie bracket of the basis vectors into D acting on the dual basis element. And so the other two pieces vanish because if you take an element of a basis and a dual basis, you simply get a delta. And then acting on that with a vector is just going to give you zero. So what this means is if I put it together and rewrite, this implies that the torsion tensor is equal to d of omega a plus theta ac cross omega c. So this is Cartan's first structural equation. So for now, just hold the thought. There is a reason for it. It actually makes computing of curvature extremely straightforward, but you have to sort of see it in action. So this is simply relating. It's sort of structural. It's telling you you've got a dual basis, the basis of one forms. You take the exterior derivative, connection piece, and in our general relativity situation, there's no torsion, so that vanishes. So that's the connection, or how to define it mathematically. So now let's look at curvature. So at the moment, I'm not really telling you anything about the physics of what we're doing. I'm just talking about how, about the maths, about how to define it, and how to define it geometrically. So the connection components per se, were not actually a tensor. They're not something that's geometric. They're more a set of rules about going between different tangent spaces. Curvature, on the other hand, is going to have some physical significance. It's going to have some meaning. And so a good analogy to think about curvature, particularly for those that are more comfortable in field theory, it's to actually compare this with what's going on with your gauge theories. So so when you sort of start off looking in sort of general at gauge field theories, you start off by sort of looking at global symmetries, and then you say, well, what happens if we want to make that symmetry local? And you very rapidly realize as soon as you make a global symmetry local, you pick up extra pieces when you differentiate your field. You need to get rid of those extra pieces, and so this is why you introduce a gauge field, so that you get gauge invariance. And so you have the gauge derivative of a scalar field, say, for example, I'm just doing a simple, simple charge scalar here, that now transforms covariantly under a gauge transformation. And so this is your gravitational analogy here. So you can sort of see the same structurally. It's very similar. And in fact, I guess it's even more similar if you look over here at this sort of expression, d plus theta. And then your electromagnetic field, or whatever. So the electromagnetic, if you've got an abelian symmetry, is defined by a commutator of derivatives. And so that is how you define your field strength, because that is the appropriate definition if you want to go to non-abelian gauge groups to give you your non-abelian field strength. And so what we do here is pretty much the same thing. So we're going to define curvature as a commutator of derivatives. And so this is curvature itself is, as you can see it, the way I've written it down, is really, it's a map. It takes three vectors and gives you a vector back. So it's a map from TP of M cross TP of M cross TP of M into TP of M. So if I write it in components, and I would get the, it's a map from three copies of TP of M into TP of M, so that tells me it's got three covariant indices and one contravariant index. And so I would simply choose U, and V, and W to be basis vectors. And so once I do that, choosing U, V, and W to be basis vectors, I then see how I get these connection components, because I've now got the covariant derivative acting on basis vectors, which was precisely how gamma was defined. So it's not too hard to see how those particular combinations arise, and probably the only thing that you may not have seen before is that final term. Have I got my...
You had the contraction of
Yes, you are right. Yeah, I think it is a D because it comes from that final piece. If you put in C, E, C, E, D for U and V, then you get the structure constants C, D coming from the Lie derivative on the last term. Thanks. So I'm just going to wrap up by finishing off saying what Cartan's second structural equation is. So, having defined the curvature as this commutator of derivatives, I've got, I can then extract the components. And then, in a similar way that I defined the connection one forms, I define the curvature two forms. So, again, coming back to Anna's point, probably worth, laboring it. Each of these objects is a two form. You can see that from the omega cross omega here. And the A and B just label different two forms. And then Cartan's second structural equation is the following. Now, if you recall your expression for a non-abelian gauge field strength, you'll remember that your sort of G mu nu is something like d dB or d, d dA, d of the vector field plus the commutator of two copies of your gauge field. So if you think of these thetas as being analogous to a gauge field, then you see that the field strength is d theta plus theta wedge theta. So it's simply bringing out, if you like, quite a nice analogy with gauge theory. So general relativity, it isn't a gauge theory in the way most particle physicists think of it. But there are many analogies because, of course, there's a huge gauge group in general relativity. The gauge group in general relativity, so this is talking about what invariances have you. Remember, we said the manifold was covered with all these coordinate charts. Well, choice of coordinates is actually a choice of gauge in general relativity. And so here you're seeing what happens under a change of gauge. You had to add a piece to your derivative to make it covariant, derivatives of vectors, and that piece was the connection. So the connection is like the gauge field in a very real sense. And then once you've got a connection, you can then ask, what is this, does it carry any geometric information? In other words, is it just that you've written flat space in a particularly perverse way, or is there really curvature there? And so that's why you take this combination here. So this has sort of thrown quite a bit of formalism. What we'll now sort of move on to is actually seeing it in action.
I was thinking it's not just an analogy because the structure equation still holds on a principal bundle for a gauge theory.
Yeah, I know it's more than an analogy. I think I'm always, what I don't want to do is to sort of try and I think there is a real difference between gravity and gauge theories because gauge theories always use a very your sort of space-time manifold is like the background, it's on which you are painting all of your physics. Whereas, at least with general relativity, gravity and the background are pretty much sort of, very much intertwined. And I think that does lead to differences. So I'm saying it's an analogy, I think, from that. But I think the differences are probably, I think you usually have to dig quite hard. So I think I'm just being cautious.